Hello and welcome to this July 2018 episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm Chris, the magazine's editor, and I'm joined in the studio today by staff writer Ian.
Hello.
And news editor Ezzy.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to Professor Chris Scott about predicting outbursts from the sun and telling you our top stargazing tip for the month. But now, we're going to take a look at what's hot in the July edition of the magazine. Ian, what's caught your eye?
Well, it's been a bit of a... we've had a, kind of two features in this issue that are kind of looking back and to the future of NASA, really, because July marks 60 years since President Eisenhower signed the National Aeronautics and Space Act, effectively bringing NASA into being. So we've got a feature on 60 years of NASA, kind of looking back at some of the highlights, written by Libby Jackson, who's a space writer who works for the UK Space Agency. And when I was kind of talking to her about the feature when we were kind of organising it, I mean, we both kind of realised that it's actually quite difficult to narrow down all the things that have happened, you know, at NASA over six decades, because you immediately think of Apollo, Hubble Space Telescope, and Space Shuttle, and things like that. But there are lots of other things that
they've done so much.
Yeah, exactly. When you think like Voyager, Curiosity, Cassini, New Horizons, all the planetary exploration,
and there's so many smaller things that they've done that people don't even really think about, like all of the telescopes, things like Spitzer and WISE and things like that, that were out there doing amazing research, but most people never really appreciated them.
Yeah, there was a mission that I came across called COBE. I don't know if you guys were aware of it. It finished in 1993, but it was a mission to explore the cosmic microwave background, which is kind of the radiation left over from the Big Bang, isn't it?
Or was that before WMAP?
I think it was the first one to get one of those, you know, kind of the sort of like elongated oval shapes with the various different colours in that you see when you think of cosmic background radiation maps. Yeah, it was the first one of that. And when you, I always find it really fascinating if you look at that one where it's really blobby and you can sort of see like there's a patch of blue here and a patch of red here, and then you look at the ones that we get now from WMAP.
Yeah.
And it's just, you can really see the advancement that NASA has made in that
time. So much better resolution, isn't there, on that? Yeah, and they do so much, don't they? They do a load of Earth observation as well. There's so many satellites go out there monitoring all aspects of the climate and the ocean and everything like that, which we don't really cover in the magazine because it's not our remit as such. But they do a lot of stuff, don't they?
Yeah, and kind of more recently, I suppose, what's kind of making the headlines is all the exoplanet discoveries. Yeah, I mean, Kepler has discovered over 2,000 confirmed exoplanets to date.
Incredible.
And Spitzer, Spitzer was the mission that discovered the TRAPPIST-1 star system with seven Earth-like planets.
Mm-hmm.
Libby also speaks in the feature to Steve J. Dick, who was the NASA chief historian from 2003 to 2009. So she kind of gets his thoughts on the past, present, and future of NASA.
Do you reckon NASA has got to be one of the most famous acronyms in the world?
I think it has to be.
Yeah. Because it's slightly better than the body that was NASA before NASA started.
NACA.
NACA, which is a great acronym, really, isn't it?
It's not good, is it?
Which stood for the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics.
Yeah.
But actually, I don't think people acronymized, if that's a word. I don't think it is. But they didn't create an acronym out of that. It was just NACA.
But the interesting, one of the interesting points in the feature is also that, before its inception, there was the idea of making it like a military operation to kind of say, get American and Western presence in space, because this was obviously kind of during the Cold War. But it was kind of scientists who said, no, that this should be peaceful and international, and it should be about science. It should be about discovering things, not about kind of marking our territory. So it's kind of interesting to hear the aspect of it as well. And we're also looking to the future of NASA because, of course, next year they plan to start, for the first time in decades, it would be, wouldn't it, launching American astronauts from American soil.
Yeah, it is decades now, isn't it? Because the last one was in 2000 and
I want to say 11 was the last shuttle launch.
Yes, of course.
Almost a decade then.
Yeah.
Wow, so, yeah.
since the retirement of the space shuttle, obviously American astronauts have been and European astronauts have booked space on the Soyuz capsule and rockets to take them to the ISS. And Shivani Bhattacharya has written us a feature on what's going to be happening in the next few years, because it's quite exciting. SpaceX and Boeing are going to be taking on the contracts to fly American astronauts to the International Space Station. Which I don't know. Like, what do you guys think? Because when I was thinking about this, I mean, one of the kind of most iconic moments, I suppose, of the space race was the Apollo-Soyuz docking in 1975. Mm. And it kind of showed that international collaboration between Russian and American astronauts. You know, they docked their capsules and they kind of, you know, had food together and they shook hands and all that kind of stuff, and they greeted each other in their native tongues. Mm. Do you think, is there an argument to be made that we might lose that sense of international cooperation if the two big space superpowers stick to their own soil?
I don't think so, because they're still they still work on the International Space Station together, people will still be, they'll still have to learn Russian probably. And Russian astronauts will probably still have to learn English. And I think there will be a lot of back and forth, because they do still have to live and work together on the International Space Station for at least the next, I think it's been extended until at least 2024.
Yeah.
I hope so as well. And also you have potentially with another relationship starting up with Europe and China. European Space Agency is getting much more involved with their Tiangong stations.
It's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it's... I think you're right, Ezzy, that, you know, that it's the place for international cooperation. Mm. And that's the way to do space, isn't it? To do it in a kind of, as a human undertaking, rather than as a kind of nationalistic effort. But I think that... NASA's not going to go away, is it? I mean, these Boeing and SpaceX are still going to be subcontracted by NASA, so they're still going to have the kind of umbrella overview of what they're doing and all their activities. So there won't be a day when we have like kind of every single company. You've got the Amazon space, you know. I mean, Amazon do have one. Jeff Bezos does have Blue. Blue Origin.
Blue Origin.
So, you know, they have kind of five or six different launches up there.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
So that's it for you, Ian. So what I've spotted in the magazine this month, which I really enjoyed, is on July the 6th, it's Aphelion Day.
Yay!
So...
What does that mean?
Aphelion Day is the day when planet Earth is furthest from the sun, which is slightly strange, because it's, you know, it's summer, it's hot here, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. Mm. But actually, it's when the Earth is furthest in its orbit from the sun, and it's about 5 million kilometres further away than it is at perihelion, which is the closest. So, you know, it's a nice day to mark. This doesn't actually mean it's going to make much difference at all.
Mm.
If you're into solar observing, the difference between furthest and nearest in a telescope is about just over one arc minute, which is about 1/60th of your little finger held out at arm's length. So
that's,
you know,
not a lot. A little
it's
finger.
Not a lot. It's not a lot at all. It's a nice thing to have around and maybe get printed on a T-shirt.
And it is the sort of thing. I mean, you know, you could kind of take an image of the sun and then wait for half a year and then take another image and then compare them to see if you can actually notice any difference.
Yes.
You know,
that's a cool kind of idea. Thing. Yeah.
If anybody
that's
does
really
do
good.
That, we'd love to see it.
Definitely.
I always think it's weird, because usually if aphelion, when you have a planet or whatever, it's aphelion, you can't see it. It's on the other side of the sun. It's too far away. So I quite like the idea that this is the one aphelion that we can actually see.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Yeah. And of course, there's lots of detail you can see on the sun, safely, of course, with a properly filtered telescope. And we cover that in the magazine this month as well. All the things that you can see in with white light, with a white light filter, which is stuff like sunspots and the granulation on the surface of the sun, which always gives me makes me feel slightly, it's like unnerves me slightly.
Yeah.
Whenever I see these kind of pictures of the surface of the sun and all these huge convection cells kind of bubbling up to the surface, it's like a kind of giant pot of of lava or bubbling stew. And I think, that's horrible. When you realise each one of those is probably about the size of our planet.
It's like, yeah, it's one of those things that when you sort of work out, it's like, oh, they look quite like small and dainty and fiddly. And then you actually work out how big they are and it's like, we are tiny.
Yes, speaking of which, we should get out for some solar observing. I haven't done that in a while.
No, we could get the hydrogen alpha telescope out. Shouldn't we take it out to the park on a nice sunny day?
A bit of lunchtime observing?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And actually, you were saying it during when we were producing the issue that it was one of the things you spotted in the issue was about the dynamic nature of the sun.
Yes. So this issue, I was writing about the Parker Solar Telescope, which is going to be an amazing mission that's going to go and touch the sun, they say. It's going to actually fly through the sun's corona, which is the first time that we've actually managed to do that. So it's an amazing feat. It's going to get within 6.3 million kilometres of the sun. That admittedly doesn't sound very close, but that's within 4.5 times the solar diameter. And when you consider how hot this thing is, it's having to sort of really beef itself up to be able to withstand that environment. So hopefully we should learn quite a lot from that over the next few years.
I mean, it's a good opportunity to study a star, really, I suppose, isn't it? It's kind of our best opportunity of doing it. But the thing I just can't get my head around is actually that we have the technology to build something that can withstand that heat.
It's taken 60 years. It was I was talking to Nikki Fox, who was the project scientist of the Parker Solar Telescope, and she was telling me that back when NASA first started, they came up with, I think it was about 12 or 14 missions that they wanted to do. And this was back in like 1970. And the Parker Solar Probe is the last one to be done because it's taken this long for them to get the technology together to be able to withstand the extreme conditions.
So are they like loads of kind of frazzled spacecraft orbiting the sun out there?
There's a couple that they've sent, but they've the ones that they've gone before have either been like taking quite a few steps back, they've viewed from afar, basically. But the thing I also found really funny about the Parker's Hope is that actually the heat is pretty easy to deal with. You put a heat shield on the front, and as provided that can stand, it's fine. The problem's actually the cold, because it has to swing out to the orbit of Venus. It kind of flybys the sun and goes out to the orbit of Venus. And when it's out there, it gets really, really cold. So they've had to put like heat blankets and heaters to prevent it from freezing up, which I thought was just such an odd idea.
That's weird, isn't it?
The actual journey it's going to make is incredible as well, because obviously you can't just apply the brakes as soon as you get to the sun. So they have to actually, is it like flybys of Venus to use the orbit to slow
it will
down?
Use a gravitational slingshot around Venus 7 times. Usually when people do that, it's to get more speed, but actually in this time it's to lose the speed that you get from the Earth, basically.
Is this going to be the fastest when it launches? It's going to be the fastest.
I knew it was going to be fastest. I didn't quite appreciate the difference. It's first one, I think it was Juno, had to go around 140,000 kilometers per hour to get to Jupiter. This is going to have to go at 690,000 kilometers per hour. So it's not just smashed the record, it's like tripled it.
Off the scale. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, but I think this one's much lighter.
Wow, hey.
Yeah.
Wow, that's quite incredible.
And it will also teach us a lot about one of the reasons why we're going is because we're trying to learn a lot more about the dynamic nature of the sun, as you said. So learn how the activity works on it and why it produces these massive solar flares. And it's these solar flares that can occasionally interact with Earth and be quite dangerous. And I think, Ian, you were finding out a bit more about that.
Yeah, that brings me nicely onto this episode's interview. I spoke to Professor Chris Scott, who's a space and atmospheric physicist from the University of Reading, talking to him basically about the dynamic activity of the sun, coronal mass ejections, and the effect and the dangers that it can have for life on Earth. I spoke to him this week, and I started off by asking him if he could explain exactly what space weather is.
What is space weather? Well, that's a matter of opinion, really. In broad terms, it's how the sun and solar activity affect the Earth's space environment. But some people catch it in terms of how it will affect Earth's technology. So we've got an ever-increasing fleet of spacecraft. We've got power grids on the ground. We've got navigational satellites, etc. And what we're most concerned about is how solar activity is going to affect the technologies that we rely on.
Mm-hmm. So just how dangerous is the sun? I mean, what sort of effect does it have on society on Earth?
Well, the average person on the ground is unlikely to be aware of any direct effect, because the most dangerous thing about the sun, as far as life is concerned, is the extreme ultraviolet and X-rays that it emits. And these are very energetic wavelengths of light that if we were exposed to them would cause us great harm. But we are lucky that we've got a big thick atmosphere above us on our planet, and so the upper atmosphere absorbs all these horrible gases, and that's what forms the Earth's ionosphere, which is the electrical layers at the top of our atmosphere. Our atmosphere is protecting us from the most direct impacts. But the sun is also a variable star. It's not just sitting benignly in space shining at us. It does have an activity cycle of about 11 years. And throughout that cycle, it throws out huge eruptions known as coronal mass ejections, which is a dull name for something that's really quite astonishing. There are about a billion tons of material traveling at a million miles an hour. And forecasting when they're going to occur and what direction they're going in is one of the challenges that we're facing in understanding space weather. If one of these arrives at our planet, if the magnetic field contained within that cloud is in the opposite direction of our Earth's magnetic field, the two fields can merge, and that allows all kinds of electrical and energetic effects to occur. So energetic particles fall into our atmosphere, and that causes the aurora at the north and south poles. Again, that's extremely high up. The lowest part of the aurora is about 100 kilometres, and that's the altitude you need to get to be declared an astronaut. So we're still talking on the edge of space as far as that's concerned. But it causes currents to flow in the atmosphere, and those currents can induce currents to flow through rocks on the ground. And if those excess currents get into our power grids, they can cause surges of power that the power grids weren't designed to carry, and that has in the past caused issues such as in 1989 there was a storm that caused excess currents to flow through the grid in Canada, and it burned out some transformers there in the middle of October, I think, for a number of hours. And that, you know, Canada is not a place you want to be without power at that time of year. So our power companies are doing a lot to try and understand the excesses of space weather so that they can protect themselves. And of course, in space, we have an ever increasing fleet of spacecraft. And so engineers need to know what are the extremes of the space environment they need to design their spacecraft to survive in. Again, excess currents flowing, static charge building up on spacecraft, or energetic particles zapping through the electronics is something that, as we get better and better at miniaturizing our electronics, these spacecraft are potentially getting more and more vulnerable, and we need to understand that. A sort of spacecraft like Sputnik, which would have been full of valves, would barely have noticed a solar storm, I imagine. But the sort of modern spacecraft we have now, where all the electronics is on miniaturized on circuit boards, we need to understand the effects of space weather so that we can make sure that those work reliably.
Yes, I mean, it's something that kind of springs to mind when you think about the Parker Solar Probe, which is going to actually study the sun up close. I mean, it's difficult to get your head around how we can actually create something that would be able to withstand the heat of the sun at such a close distance.
I know. I worked on the STEREO mission, which was a mission that looked between the sun and the Earth to look for these solar storms as they head towards us, and that's in an Earth-like orbit. And the amount of effort that you have to go into to make sure that the electronics are working at a reasonable temperature is quite astonishing. There's lots of computer modelling and thermal modelling and all kinds of things. So I've not been party to the calculations required to get the solar probe as close as it's going to the sun, but it's going to have a big shield at the front to try and protect the instrumentation. The instrumentation is basically going to have to peek around it. And it's an incredible feat of engineering. It's really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing the results back.
Yes, and just to go back to the coronal mass ejections that you mentioned, this is a term that kind of anyone who's interested in solar astronomy to any degree will have heard of. I was wondering if you could just explain what's the science behind these CMEs? What's actually going on at the surface of the sun?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because the sun is a fluid. It's a magnetized, it's a fluid that's incredibly hot, so that electrifies the particles within it. And that as that fluid churns around, it generates its own magnetic field, like the magnetic field is generated in the Earth's core. But the sun rotates. It's not a static body. It rotates roughly around once every 27 days. But the equator of the sun rotates faster than the poles. So the poles take around 30 days to rotate. The equator goes around once every 25 days. So if you can imagine the sort of classic dipole field where you have a north pole and a south pole and you have field lines threading from one to the other, as this differential rotation moves the equator faster than the poles, it gradually stretches that magnetic field with it and gradually wraps that magnetic field around and around the sun. And when you stretch or distort a magnetic field like that, you're storing energy in it. And the analogy I like to use is if you have a little model aircraft that's powered by a rubber band and you wind the propeller as much as you can, you can see the elastic band getting more and more twisted and contorted as you're storing the energy in it. And if you're a belligerent child like I was, you keep going as fast as you possibly can to see how much you can twist this elastic band. And it starts to knot and twist and get very, very complicated in its shape. And that's what happens to the sun's magnetic field. It gradually gets more and more complicated and knots form in it, and those break out through the surface. And where you have these intense regions of magnetic field, it actually prevents the material from rising up from the solar interior. There's a sort of convection, like rice on the boil going on over the whole of the sun as the heat is gradually transmitted to the surface. But where you have these intense magnetic fields, it suppresses that, and so they appear cooler. And so to our eyes, if you were looking, obviously, with the correct filters and or projecting an image of the sun, you would see these regions as dark spots, and that's the what we call a sunspot. And so these sunspots change throughout the solar cycle. You get more and more of them as this magnetic field wraps up and becomes distorted. But then what happens is you have these eruptions as the magnetic field reconfigures itself, and it releases giant bubbles of material from the solar atmosphere carrying the magnetic field with it. And that gradually, throughout the course of the cycle, reconfigures the magnetic field of the sun until the south pole's at the top and the north pole's at the bottom. And then, of course, the continual motion of the sun gradually unwinds that field until you're back to the initial condition again. So while the activity cycle on the sun takes 11 years approximately, the magnetic cycle takes 22 years because it takes two of those activity cycles to get back to a north pole at the top. So we tend to get these mass ejections occurring more often at when the sun's at its peak activity, when you see more spots, when you have many more of these active regions, these very complicated magnetic structures. And when the sun's at its solar minimum years, you see fewer spots and you tend to get fewer mass ejections, although you still get them. And that really is quite an interesting result. But they tend to be less severe.
Just how reliable is this cycle of activity that the sun goes through? Are we actually able to kind of predict things like CMEs, and does it kind of follow a fairly strict pattern?
That's the million-dollar question. No is the short answer. The cycles can vary in length, so they can be slightly longer than 11 years, they can be slightly shorter, and there's been many an attempt to try and predict the next activity cycle based on the previous ones, and so lots of different techniques. When I was an undergraduate at university, one of our lecturers had just achieved some kind of positive notoriety by correctly predicting the peak activity of the cycle that we were seeing. And so everyone was thinking that perhaps their technique was the one that we should be going with. But of course, it's a great thing to make a prediction over 11 years, because if you do it mid-career, you're usually retired by the time you're proved right or wrong again. And that unfortunately proved to be the case with this prediction. So it is very difficult. And the sun recently has just gone extremely quiet. In 2007, around then, the sun went completely quiet. There were very few sunspots, and there was a big stretch where there were no sunspots at all. The solar wind just dropped to a very low, well, relatively low speed. It's still travelling at about 400 kilometres a second. But again, it was, and the solar wind was very thin, and so the conditions at Earth were a lot calmer as far as the solar weather was concerned than they had been previously. And so we know that the sun does vary on longer cycles as well. We can see some evidence of this within the geological record on Earth with all the isotopes that are generated by energetic particles in space interacting with our atmosphere. But we don't have enough observations yet to actually tie down what those are. And so it could be that the sun is going into a period of much quieter activity, which sounds great, but under those conditions, the sun's magnetic field is in space is weaker, and that field actually protects us from very energetic particles called galactic cosmic rays that are accelerated in distant supernova explosions. So there's no good time to be in space. You're either being irradiated by the solar particles that are being accelerated in the solar wind, or you're being irradiated by galactic cosmic rays.
It's not much of a choice, is it? if someone has been listening to this interview and has been inspired and wants to know more about the sun, I thought it would be a good time to bring up the Solar Stormwatch Citizen Science Project that I believe you're involved in. I was wondering if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Solar Stormwatch was born out of the fact that when I was working with the STEREO mission, we were getting many hundreds of thousands of images in from the spacecraft, and we only had a very small team to observe them. And so as a science team, we could pick out the events that we wanted to study in detail, but there was just too much data. And in talking with Chris Lintott and his team at the University of Oxford that were developing this Zooniverse idea of asking people to help you with your science, and together with the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, we put together a project called Solar Stormwatch, which we asked people to look at the images and to tell us what they saw in them and to help track features that we saw. And that was incredibly successful. We had something like 20,000 volunteers from around the world who helped us, and we got 7 scientific papers out of it. So it's not just asking people to do something for no purpose. We actually using this for the science. There's just more than we can possibly do. And we've relaunched Solar Stormwatch recently to get people to actually look at these storms in our cameras and to draw around the edge of them. And that might seem like a really prosaic thing to do, but these are very fluffy clouds in space, and deciding where the edge of these storms is a subjective judgment. Mm. And so one scientist can say, well, I think it's here, but we have no idea any more than the next man. So getting many people to look at the same image and to tell us where they think the edge is, we can get some consensus. And so that consensus is very useful because it tells us not only where the edge is, but it also tells us how uncertain people think that edge is. And so we can compare very clean CMEs that have got a very well-defined edge and some that are a lot fainter, and we can get people to compare between them. And then most recently, we've launched another project, which if you want to look at the Solar Stormwatch project and help us with that, we're very grateful. That's www.solarstormwatch.com. But if you go to the Zooniverse platform, which is zooniverse.org, you can see that there's another project there called Help Save Planet Earth from Solar Storms. And that's a project which we're looking at these storms to, in conjunction with the Science Museum, have a major new exhibit coming up on the sun this autumn. And so they wanted to have some citizen science element to it. And we're asking people that. We're showing them one picture from every storm that we've seen in the STEREO cameras and asking people to compare them and tell us which one they think looks the most complicated. We're trying to get some kind of ranking order for the complexity of these storms and seeing if that tells us something about whether the actual nature of the storm varies throughout the cycle and which ones are going to be more impactful when they arrive at Earth.
That's absolutely fascinating, and so there's clearly plenty for people to get involved with if they want to know more, or if they're interested, or if they want to get involved in actual scientific studies.
Absolutely. I didn't sound too needy, did I? But we really are desperate for people's help. There's so much data, and the more people looking at it, the more we'll find out from it.
And presumably this is something that you don't need any kind of experience of solar astronomy or knowledge, a scientific degree or anything to help out with?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, if you come at the data with no preconceptions, I think that's an advantage. We give you a little brief tutorial to explain what you're looking at and the sorts of features that we're interested in identifying. And then it's for you to tell us what you think you're seeing. And I think that's really important. It's very easy for one expert to just proclaim what they think the edge is, but that's not as valuable as many people looking at it and agreeing or disagreeing as to where they think the edge is.
Fantastic. Okay, well, Professor Scott, thank you very much for speaking to me today. It's been brilliant, and hopefully people will get involved in these various projects.
It's been great talking with you.
That was Professor Chris Scott. Find out more about space weather and solar outbursts in July's issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine. There's a load to see in the night sky this month, which you can find out all about in our guide to the night sky in this month's issue. But if there's one thing you really should see in July, it's the total eclipse of the moon. This is later in the month, on the 27th of July. Now, a total eclipse of the moon is when the moon passes through the Earth's shadow. If you kind of picture them in a line, you've got the moon, the Earth, and the sun, with the Earth in the middle. And because the light from the sun is in effect filtering through Earth's atmosphere before it reaches the moon appears blood red at fullest eclipse. And here in the UK, the eclipse will already have started by the time the moon rises in the southeast on the 27th, which is about 9:10 in the evening. So what we'll see here is this blood-red moon rising up from the horizon. Now, the sky will still be light at this point, so it might be a bit tricky to spot. The full eclipse, the red part, finishes about 10:10, so against a darker sky. But for 2 hours after that, the moon will still look darker than usual as it moves out of partial eclipse. Now, there's two other important things to say about this. Firstly, it's all kicking off on the same day that planet Mars reaches opposition, when it's highest and brightest in the sky for several years. And it's going to be a perihelic opposition, so it's closer to Earth in its orbit and brighter than at any time in the last 15 years. Pretty amazing. Mars rises just under the eclipsed moon, so from about 10:10 on the 27th, there'll be an awesome view, low to the southeastern horizon, of a red moon and a red planet below it. It's pretty special. The second thing is that July the 27th is a Friday. So, find a pub with a garden or get to a park nearby with a family. Rarely has a celestial event been this well-timed. So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about space weather and solar outbursts in the July issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also review a Dobsonian scope, a short tube refractoscope and a specialist astrophoto camera, check in on progress with US plans for crewed commercial space flights, preview next year's South American eclipse, and have a total of 99 top observing and imaging targets to take a look at in the night sky. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.